From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. There are plenty of jokes out there disparaging lawyers and the legal profession as a whole. But of course, it's easy to make fun of attorneys until you need one. And right now, Oregon needs one. Or more precisely, Oregon needs hundreds. Today on the show, you'll hear from a reporter from the Guardian newspaper about how a crushing lack of attorneys, especially public defenders, is doing great harm to the state and its citizens. It's been a crisis that's been building for quite some time. And right now, there are thousands of people in the state who are charged with crimes they didn't commit, overcharged for minor offenses, or in legal limbo simply because they can't see a lawyer. Then, in the second part of the show, we'll check in with KLCC's Love Cross on her Oregon Ready series. That's next on Oregon on the Record. Imagine getting a letter in the mail that says you're being charged with a crime you didn't commit and ordered to appear before a judge. But when you appear, you're told you have to wait an unknown period of time for a lawyer before you can even try to clear it up. Sounds like a nightmare, but it's all too real for many Oregonians. A Guardian reporter explains. Sam Levin, a senior reporter with The Guardian. Sam, great to talk to you again. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
I read your recent story titled Falsely Charged with a Crime, No Way to Fight It Inside Oregon's Court Crisis. Let's start with this. Tell us the story of, I believe it's Corshell Jenkins. What happened to her?
Corshell Jenkins is a mom of six. She works as a medication technician at a senior living facility, and one day last year, she got a letter in the mail saying that she had failed to appear in court and there was a warrant for her arrest. She was extremely shocked because she had never been arrested for theft. She had no idea what this was. It was clear to her that this was mistaken identity. But she went into court and tried to resolve the matter and learned that she could not fight her case or make arguments of wrongful prosecution without an attorney. And she could not get an attorney because Oregon has a massive shortage of public defenders. So all she could do was wait for a lawyer, which started a nearly year-long saga for her.
That's amazing. Could you give us some numbers, you know, not just with Corshell, but with other folks, you know, in terms of, you know, how many cases this the same thing that happened to her are happening to other people? And what are we talking about here? How many attorneys does Oregon need to be able to have a more balanced system?
Yeah, those are great questions. When Corshell first entered the court system, there were roughly 4,000 defendants across Oregon who were waiting for a lawyer at that time. So that's people who had been arraigned and charged with crimes and said, I need a court-appointed lawyer. I can't afford my own attorney. And the state agreed that they needed a court-appointed lawyer but could not get one. Today, that number is smaller, but it's still around 1,200 people waiting for lawyers, with roughly 600 in Multnomah County in Portland, where she's based. And the question of how many lawyers does Oregon need to resolve this crisis is actually a very complicated one that I couldn't get a straightforward answer to despite spending months on this story. And that's partly due to the very convoluted way that Oregon provides public defense through a patchwork of contractors and nonprofits and individuals. And so Oregon does not have a clear number of how many people are currently working in public defense or how many they would need to solve the crisis.
Wow. And I'm wondering, too, could Ms. Jenkins, could she have tried to defend herself, or is there a statute that says, no, you can't do that?
People are allowed to represent themselves if they choose to do so, but I think generally that's not advised as someone who's not, you know, having a legal background and not a lawyer. And I think for her, it was clear she wanted to wait for a lawyer. She had to wait for a lawyer. I don't think she was presented with an option of you can represent yourself if you want. It was just a very straightforward, we don't have a lawyer for you today, Ms. Jenkins. Please come back to your next court hearing and we'll see if we have one for you then. I listened to the court hearing. It was very brief. It was just come back to court. And if you don't come back to court, there will be a warrant for your arrest. And she did come back to court. And when she came back to court, they said, sorry, we still don't have a lawyer for you.
Wow. Can you talk about what can be amazingly challenging impacts on people because of this problem here in Oregon.
Yeah, that was my goal for the story, was to really understand the human toll of this crisis, which has been brewing for years. And we see really extreme impacts on people who are stuck waiting for lawyers. On a basic level, when you are charged with a crime, there are many conditions that are put in place. Some people remain in jail. Others who are released have pre-trial conditions, which might mean they have to wear an ankle monitor, or they're barred from going to certain places, or they might be restricted from seeing their family, you know, having child custody issues, very serious consequences. And without a lawyer, you have no way to challenge those consequences. You have no way to argue that, you know, you deserve to be able to travel to work and that it's important that you maintain a relationship with your kids. And at the same time, having a charge hanging over you has very serious consequences in this country. It affects people's ability to get jobs, to get housing, really fundamental stuff, because this is a criminal record that is hanging over you. So Korshell's case was obviously particularly extraordinary because she was accused of a crime she did not commit. It was just completely false. And she had this charge hanging over her. And so that meant she couldn't apply for a job she wanted to get because it was on her record and it would automatically prohibit her from being able to do this job. So it was really affecting her life, not only with that, but also the fear of missing court and then having a warrant out for your arrest, which means that if an officer stops you for a traffic violation, they would then take you to jail.
Yeah, yeah. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking with Sam Levin. He's a senior reporter with The Guardian. So maybe this is the million-dollar question. How did we get here in Oregon?
It's a long journey to how we got here in Oregon, stemming in part from the fact that it's very hard to recruit people for public defense jobs. They are lower paying lawyer positions. They're very demanding, high caseloads. And so that's always been a challenge. Then during COVID, when the courts shut down, it led to just a severe backlog of cases. So as Oregon was getting out of the pandemic, there was this huge backlog of cases, just people waiting for attorneys, and the problem just got worse and worse. And at the same time, Oregon was struggling with a worsening homelessness and drug addiction crisis, which was really bleeding its way into the court system. So public defenders were getting cases with really just complex issues, people with mental health challenges, struggling with homelessness and addiction. So that further created problems. And we saw the rise in body camera footage, which led to just significant amount of time burdens on public defenders who are required to really review hours and hours of footage to properly represent their clients. So every case was taking longer. And this just ballooned into a bigger and bigger problem over the last 4 or so years.
So kind of a perfect storm of not enough attorneys, people dropping out of being public defenders, and more crimes being levied against people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, people just, the public defenders were getting really burnt out. And so I talked to lots of public defenders about just the exodus from the profession, you know, people moving to different jobs, jobs where they're more stable or where they'll be paid better. And that just had a cascading effect, because the more you lost attorneys, the more you were unable to represent people being charged with crimes. And the longer that list got, the harder it was to get that list to be lower. And so the problem just got worse and worse.
You also talked about what the state Supreme Court is considering. Talk about that, what their potential remedy is. Not remedy, but action they have to take.
Yeah, well, it's important to remember that people have a constitutional right to a lawyer. That's in the state constitution and in the United States Constitution. And so this has been litigated for a long time. And there was a case centering on a man named Alan Roberts, who had essentially gone unrepresented for 4 years. He had been charged with a crime and he kept showing up to court. They kept saying he didn't have a lawyer. And so this dragged on for a really long time. And eventually, when he did get lawyers, they argued that the case should be dismissed because it's not fair or just to have him charged with a crime after 4 years. And so that ultimately led to a pretty extraordinary ruling where the state Supreme Court said that essentially the state had to dismiss cases of people who had been waiting for more than 90 days for counsel for felonies and after 60 days for misdemeanors. And so that meant that about 1,400 cases had to just be dropped because those people had been waiting too long for attorneys and their rights had been violated. And so that ruling is moving forward now. If people have their cases going past 60 or 90 days, depending on misdemeanor or felony, that means those cases have to be dismissed in the interest of, you know, their rights being violated in the wait for an attorney.
Okay. Is this exclusively happening in Oregon? Are there other states that are facing this same problem?
This is not an Oregon exclusive problem. We've seen similar issues in Massachusetts, Maine, and Wisconsin. So this has happened across the country, but few of those crises have been at the scale and duration as Oregon's crisis, which has just gone on for so long and has impacted so many thousands of people. And I think that's partly due to Oregon's convoluted public defense bureaucracy and due to the really intense homelessness and addiction crises that have really impacted the court system in Oregon.
Okay. And I would imagine this disproportionately impacts people of color, people of lower income. Is that true?
Yeah, well, we know people who are impacted by the criminal legal system are disproportionately low income and people of color. And of course, by nature, people who need public defenders are people who can't afford attorneys on their own. And so I sat in court many times in the reporting process of this, and you see that the people shuffling in and out of court, confused by the process, navigating this without attorneys, are often, especially if you're in like a misdemeanor court where it's lower level crimes, it's often unhoused people or people struggling with addiction. You know, these minor crimes like trespassing where they were, you know, in a 7-Eleven and then were told to leave and they didn't leave, or someone who got cited for unlawful camping and then had to keep going back to court to fight the case but couldn't get an attorney. So these are really marginalized people who are suffering at the hands of this system where they don't have the ability to fight their cases. And they often don't understand what's happening. It's very confusing to show up to court. And if you don't have a lawyer assigned to your case who's helping you just explain what the process is, what an arraignment is, what you're being charged with, what your rights are, it's really challenging for anyone to be able to navigate that process.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Sam Levin, a senior reporter at The Guardian. What I really enjoyed about your piece was you really, you know, talk to people and really kind of expose what they're going through. Talk about, you have a couple other folks that you talk to. Talk about what happened to Veronica Gates, and I believe it's Nasius Berry. Talk about those two individuals and what they had to go through.
Yeah, Veronica Gates was a young woman who was 20 years old who had a very minor incident where basically her car broke down in the middle of the road and she got into this argument with an officer and they ended up taking her to jail for disorderly conduct. It was her first crime. There were no victims, there were no allegations of any harm or anything serious. She was just taken to jail after some kind of argument. And she was very eager to just resolve the case, but she kept having to go back to court and go back to court because she couldn't get a lawyer. So she was just stuck waiting and waiting. And in the process, it really took a toll on her mentally and it impacted how she was applying for housing. And she stopped driving out of fear that she would have more problems with law. It really took a big toll on her life. And by the time she got a lawyer, it had been months and, you know, there was no ability to kind of build her case because surveillance footage had run out because it was months later. But the case still dragged on and on and on. And eventually, just before it was heading to trial, because she didn't want to plead, the prosecutors dismissed the case and it was over. But it really took a chunk of her life and sort of derailed things for her. And yeah, there was a similar story with Nasius Berry, who was also young and was having a mental health episode at a Starbucks. And he was jailed for, you know, quote unquote, trespassing when he wouldn't leave. Also a minor case. He got mental health treatment and turned his life around. But this case just went on for basically a year before he got an attorney. And then during that time, he couldn't apply for the fast food jobs he wanted. It was just really impacting his ability to really put his life in the right direction.
So are there any signs of improvement on this issue?
there are signs of progress. You know, we went from, you know, roughly 4,000 people waiting for an attorney to roughly 1,200 today. And so that is significant progress. And that comes through some efforts at the state level to really prioritize counties that have been having these issues with major shortages of attorneys by creating special dockets to speed up cases and by sending some, you know, state lawyers to these counties to handle trials to move them along faster. But the big problem is Multnomah County, which is the epicenter of the crisis, which has the most cases, and solutions there have just been elusive. The problem keeps happening. More and more people keep getting charged with crimes, and there just aren't enough attorneys to represent them. But we are not there yet.
Sam, as we close this out, I guess my final question is just, you know, in talking to these people who have been so upended, you know, what did they tell you in terms of just the emotions? Did they feel it was helpless, hopeless? You know, did they feel like it was important to tell the story, but also that, you know, this, if it could happen to me, it could happen to literally anyone?
Yeah. People absolutely lose faith in the system. For many of the folks I interacted with, it's their first time going through a criminal process, being charged with a crime. And there's a basic expectation that you have fundamental rights, you'll be able to argue your case. And so a lot of folks just found it really shocking and galling to show up to court and be told, sorry, nothing we can do, just come back again, and no guarantee when you come back that you'll get a lawyer. So people were really appalled by the system and hurt by it and felt abused by it. And the emotional and mental toll is really significant, because people feel trapped where they can't move on with their lives. They don't know, you know, when this case is going to end. Is it ever going to end? Is this going to keep happening? There's no guarantee. You just feel like you're stuck in this cycle where you can't get out of it. And it's really scary, because there are serious consequences.
Yeah. Well, it's an incredibly well-researched piece, great piece. Sam Levin, a senior reporter with The Guardian, really appreciate you coming on and talking about this tragic situation.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
We've been following KLCC's Oregon Ready series 1 month at a time towards being 2 weeks ready for disasters. And today, we're zeroing in on something people don't always think about until it's too late: money and paperwork after a disaster. Joining me now is KLCC's Love Cross, who's been reporting and importantly participating in this whole preparedness challenge. Hi, Love.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk last month, so I'm really glad we can connect. You've been very honest in this series that this isn't just reporting. You're kind of dragging yourself through preparedness alongside with the rest of us.
Yeah, very much so. This is not me like standing on a mountain of emergency supplies and looking down at everyone else. I am very much figuring this out in real time, that's for sure.
Okay. So recently, you've been talking about what you're calling financial first aid, which honestly doesn't sound all that exciting.
I know. You're so right. It's not the fun part of disaster prep. It's not like making tidy to-go bags or standing back and admiring our stored gallons of water. Yes, I've done that. But it turns out it might be one of the most important things you can do ahead of time, is being financially prepared.
Okay. Well, give us the big picture. What does financial first aid actually mean?
Well, at its core, it's about making sure that if something really bad happens, you know, fire, flood, earthquake, you're not trying to reconstruct your entire financial life while you're already in shock. Regulators boil it down to three things: a home inventory, copies of key documents, and understanding your insurance coverage.
Okay, let's take that first one, home inventory, because that seems like the part that probably most people are going to avoid.
Actually, that's very true. It sounds tedious, but it was kind of fun. I actually knew I should have done this years ago, but I was dragging my feet. Everyone I talked to, from regulators to insurers, said the same thing. This is where recovery starts. As part of the most recent segment, I spoke with Kenton Brine from the Northwest Insurance Council.
Three simple words: proof of loss. So the more information you have about your loss, the faster you'll get your claim handled, the more smoothly that process will go.
proof of loss sounds so clinical, but it's huge.
Yeah. And once he said it that way, it really stuck with me. Proof of loss is basically you being able to say, this is what I had, this is what happened to it, and this is what I need to replace. And that proof really starts before the disaster ever happens.
Which means you finally did the thing.
I did the thing. I walked through my house with my phone and I just started recording. Closets, walls, furniture. I narrated it like a slightly unhinged tour guide around my house.
And you included a little of that audio in your story.
Yeah, and that was me being very real about it.
We probably paid about $80 in 2009 at Pottery Barn for this side table. We bought this vintage lamp at an estate sale in 2025. I think we paid $40 for it. There's a wooden plant stand with a ceramic planter and a snake plant.
And look, my home inventory is imperfect, but imperfect is infinitely better than nothing at all.
Another point that really stood out to me was this idea that memory isn't reliable after a disaster, which makes sense, but we don't like thinking about it.
Exactly. We kind of like to assume we'll just remember, but trauma really does mess with memory in a big way.
All right, well, let's listen to Kent and Brian on that.
If you think about your state of mind after a disaster, it's really hard to imagine how you're going to respond personally, but a lot of people are just in a state of shock. They've lost everything or a significant portion of everything. If it's a fire and their home has been reduced to ash on the ground, they're literally sorting through ashes. Going to be very hard to remember the things that were in every room of that house so that you can get a fair settlement and get those things replaced as best you can.
That image of people sorting through ashes really lands.
It does. And it really changed how I thought about the inventory. It's not about being organized. It's about protecting your future self when you might not be at your best, of course.
And you found that insurance surprises a lot of people.
Yeah. Flood insurance in particular, a lot of people assume water damage is water damage. But if flooding comes from outside your house, it's not covered by standard homeowners insurance. And many people are underinsured for rebuild costs today.
So part of being ready is reading the fine print.
Yes, as painful as that sounds, it is. And also safeguarding documents, you know, like IDs, insurance policies, titles, birth certificates, so you can prove actually who you are when systems are down too.
If people listening feel overwhelmed, what's the first small step?
Well, I would advise just pick one thing. Maybe today it's recording one room in your house. Maybe it's taking photos of your important documents. You really don't have to do everything at once.
Which is kind of the whole theme of Oregon Ready.
Exactly. One manageable task at a time, together toward being 2 weeks ready. That's how I am moving through this year. And again, I want to invite disaster preparedness questions. Those can be emailed to questions@klcc.org. And I want to invite your Oregon on the Record listeners to tune in tomorrow to Morning Edition and All Things Considered, when I will be repeating some of the questions we have received and getting the answers to them. So tune in tomorrow.
She's KLCC's Love Cross. Thank you for making the unglamorous parts of preparedness feel doable.
Thanks so much for having me once again, Michael.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow, we'll bring you a special show with our guest, the former labor secretary in the Clinton administration and prolific author and lecturer, Robert Reich. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.